This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 83. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What is the word this week, sir?
I am undertaking a lot of work to create work for others right now.
Yeah, this is the work that you can't outsource, isn't it?
Yes.
It's outsourcing your work. You can't outsourcing your work.
Yep.
So what have you been up to?
So I've been going on sort of a hiring binge lately. I hired somebody to build out the Audit Shark sales website for me and essentially just come up with the design for it. I'd say for the last year or so, I've basically had the same sales website out there. I really haven't spent a lot of time or effort on it. Right now, I'm kind of focusing my efforts on building something that actually looks good and addresses the pain points that have been kind of brought to my attention that people are willing to pay for from that WooFoo survey that I ran. So I hired somebody for that, and right now I have a job opening for another .NET developer to add to the person who I already have working full-time on the Audit Shark code that he's working on. So hopefully by the end of this week, I'll have two people working on that, and then the other person will be working on the website. And then I'll have to start generating the content and stuff that's going to go into the framework that he's building for the website.
You have a WordPress site up right now, right? Just a WordPress theme that you customized like a year ago or something, and you had a logo designed, you know, by someone. So what's the impetus at this point to go back to the drawing board? Do you have like a much better design for it? Or I guess, why would you spend the time now to go back and do that rather than use what you have?
There's a few different reasons. One is to kind of switch it off of WordPress. And I've started integrating Kissmetrics kind of all throughout my website. And one of the things that is, I won't say it's a real pain in the neck to do it with WordPress, but I don't like the look and feel that comes out. I've seen the particular theme that I'm using quite a bit out there, and it's starting to wear on me a little bit. So I'd like to have a little bit more control over it. And the other thing I'd like to do is I'd like to make the sales site and the application itself look a little bit more like they were built together, because right now they just don't. But, you know, it's something that I'm going to have to do eventually. And if I get started now, then it'll be ready in like the next couple of months. Because it's not like you can just say, oh, well, I'm going to redesign this and a couple of days later it's done. I mean, it takes time to get it done.
Right.
So I'm spending the time now to find somebody to do it. And then, you know, hopefully in the next couple of months that'll get done and I won't have to worry about it.
Got it. And in the meantime, are you continuing? You had some survey results and you had 15 or 20 emails, I think, and you were going to contact those folks and kind of do some customer development interviews to find out more in depth about maybe their needs and how you would structure your copy on your marketing side, as well as potentially what you would build into the product. Have you continued with that?
Yeah. So I started talking to people and getting a little bit more of an understanding of specifically what they're looking for. And one of the things that I've come across is that in both the copy that's on the website and in my discussions with people, it's not inherently obvious exactly what the product does and why it's important. So one of the things that I came across was that the fact that Audit Shark will dynamically look at your machine and figure out what it's supposed to be looking at is not something that's clear. So, for example, if you have Apache installed on your website, then it will run all these different things on your machine to make sure that Apache's locked down. And, you know, if it's a Unix or Linux machines, it'll check different places to find out what user accounts have been created. And then we'll monitor those over time to make sure that they haven't changed. Because one of the things that people should be looking at in order to secure their systems is, are new user accounts being created? And if so, you know, what are those user accounts? It needs to notify you. And those are things that you should regularly do at some point anyway, but most people don't. But if a new user popped up on your machines, obviously that's something you would probably want to know about. If you did it, that's fine. But if you didn't do it and you just get this notification that says, oh, there's a new user account that's been created and it's got, you know, UID of 0, well, that's probably a problem.
Got it. Hey, I have a question. How many hours do you estimate that you're going to have to spend to basically kind of repurpose the code that you have, the Audit Shark code, or expand it to fit the new product idea that you're exploring? Or do you know that yet? Do you know the full feature set?
I don't specifically know that yet. I mean, a lot of the stuff is going to stay the same, and I haven't even really looked at what needs to fundamentally change in order to meet that new model. I don't believe it's a lot, but not a lot is not quantitative, I'll say. I would say maybe 50 to 100 hours, but it's probably 50 to 100 hours that I most likely would have spent anyway, because there were a lot of things that just weren't done. So things would work and they would do what they're supposed to do, but there are use case scenarios that I hadn't accounted for yet. And this particular one is one of those use case scenarios that I had thought of. I'm like, hey, I think that people would want to use this for, you know, their web servers. And I didn't have a use case scenario for them being able to install it on a web server. It was solely around them installing it in like an Active Domain environment and then running it there. So this is a use case scenario I had already scoped out and thought of ahead of time. And I don't look at it as being extra work that I wouldn't have done had I gone in this direction. I think I would have done it anyway. It's just a matter of timeline, I guess.
Right. That makes sense. Have you thought about just putting up a landing page while you're doing these interviews? You know, you do have a decent idea of what people might want, but you could get a pretty attractive landing page that's not used by anyone. You know, like off of themeforest.net, they have, I don't know, they're like $7 to $12. And there's some pretty nice ones these days. You know, John Turner he's an Academy member, and he's doing really well selling his Ultimate Coming Soon plugin, which is cool because you can then have a theme on the back end and then just have this plugin that's, you know, swaps out a landing page as your homepage. But I guess you're moving away from WordPress. But for now, you know, you could keep the WordPress install, use his plugin, and just have a few sentences describing the specific pain points, and then push off the website construction until the marketing site construction, until after you've had more time to talk to these customers and potentially have even gotten started on updating the code with the final feature set, and then kind of set someone off on building it. Have you considered that route?
Not specifically. I mean, one of the things that I was a little bit concerned about in doing something like that is the SEO that I've done on my existing web page, but I don't know if that's a huge hurdle to overcome. The bigger issue is kind of putting things onto that coming soon page that makes sense and are in line with what people are looking for. You know, some of that I think I'm still kind of straightening out, but I think that there's probably enough interest in what I've talked about so far. I mean, virtually every single person who answered the survey, with I think two exceptions out of about 30, said, yeah, add me to your mailing list. That side of it, I think, turns out pretty well. But I don't have a good reason for not doing that, so that's probably something I'll move forward with.
I see two kind of benefits to doing that over going out and building the full-fledged site right now.
Just a correction, though. I'm not having the whole site built out. I'm having basically a template built for me with all these different HTML and CSS snippets for different things that I may want to put into the site. And those will go into a full-blown .NET web application that I'll kind of put together. What I've put the contractor on is just basically building out the design for it, but not the actual content.
So I guess that what I see the benefits in the landing page is it's focused. You're just going to get more emails from it, period. You know, any visitor you send there is going to read the few bullet points you have and then either give you their email or not. Whereas if you build out more of a full site, they have to navigate through to give you their email. So you'll have a higher conversion right there. In addition, I think you're right. You're still at kind of an early in the journey of figuring out exactly what AuditTrack is going to become. And so not too hard to put together some bullet points, a few sentences describing it. Probably harder to build out, you know, the full 3, 4, 5 page site with the tour and all that stuff.
Right. That's a good suggestion. I think I'll do that. What about you? What have you been up to?
About a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I mentioned that I had rolled out Chinese character support and actually Chinese search engine support, which is, they're two different things, but they're related. I rolled them out with Hittail. So now like search engines like Baidu and someone called Songuo and just a bunch that I can't pronounce, frankly, they now work with Hittail, which is cool. And I have a quote-unquote enterprise client, my first four-figure-a-month client, trying it out now.
Cool.
So we'll see how that pans out. I'm like cautiously optimistic. I tend to be skeptical of like really good things happening or like a big break, quote-unquote. But it could be a nice one. You know, it could be good for revenue. So he's about 7 days into a trial. I just touched base with him. So
cool.
That's kind of the update on that. Now, what I've really been working on for the past 7 to 10 days is this one-click article support. Because I mentioned last time that one of the main reasons that people were canceling their Hittail accounts was because it was adding stuff to their to-do list, right? It gives them these suggestions that they should target, but they don't then want to go out and either try to write something themselves or hire a writer. And so there are a few services that basically have these big pools of writers, and you know they offer to write articles for you. And there are a few of them with APIs. And oh, really? So, yeah, so I integrated with one of them that has 80,000 riders. Now, they're not all active, but they have a huge pool of riders. And so, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer for someone like me to integrate there. There are some other services, a lot of other services that integrate with them and kind of use them as their back-end Mechanical Turk almost, right? It's like the turnaround is 1 to 2 days, depending on the length, and get a full-fledged article. And there's like a bunch of different pricing tiers and all that stuff. But I made it super simple. I'm calling this an MVF. It's a minimum viable feature. Instead of actually, when I sketched it out, of course, you know, I'm the developer entrepreneur. I was like, oh man, I want there to be all these choices. And you could do 300, 400, 500, 600 word. You can say, I want SEO or not. How many times should it, you know, should these keywords appear in there? I wanted people to be able to submit it and then review it and preview it and accept it or reject it. And, you know, there are all these options available through their API. And I kind of cranked up an estimate and realized there's no way I want to build all of that. So I chucked it all and I said, you click this button, we charge your card on file, $18 for one 400 word SEO article, and it comes back in 2 days. And there are a few options. You know, you can change the title and change the keyword and do a few other things, but it is super, super stripped down. And if this works and it pans out, and A, it helps retention, and B, it actually, you know, generates some revenue, because obviously I'm marking up the service a bit, so there's a little bit of margin for me. If that works, then I will go on and expand it, and certainly add it. Then adding it, you know, and making it a 300 and 500 word options is not actually that hard at this point. I mean, I kept all that stuff in mind while I was coding, but I just, to do all the UI work to support that would also really make the form a lot larger. So I pushed that live yesterday, and I'm super stoked that that's finally done. It's kind of the biggest new feature that I built since I acquired Hittail.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't launched it. Like, I haven't announced it to anyone. It's soft launch now. I placed one order myself just to make sure everything works. And so far, that's good. And then I think I'll slowly start emailing customers in like 10 or 20 person chunks and just kind of see how it goes before I really do a big blast in a promotional campaign. Mm-hmm.
Now, are you going to be measuring how many people kind of go through that funnel as you start telling more and more people about it?
Yeah, like how many people see the page and click versus not. Yeah, mm-hmm. I will be. Yep. So I have Kissmetrics installed. I also have Google Analytics. But you know what? Good point. I should actually install maybe Crazy Egg or even Inspectlet. Inspectlet is like the inexpensive version of Clicktail, where it does a screen recording of people doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Inspectlet supports JavaScript and divs and all that, because it's basically a light box that pops up. So I probably should do that just to watch people on that specific page.
Yeah, because if they're not seeing it, then they're not going to obviously click through it. But you want to make it visible without being, I'll say, intrusive.
Yeah, and I'm planning on adding like a little new, you know, icon at the top in Hittail. You know, there are grids that you can sort and you can page and do that stuff, but there's not a lot of adornment on purpose because we want it to be simple and fast. But if I put a big new icon at the top, I'm hoping it'll draw people's eyes.
Cool. Hey, did I tell you that I did a contest on 99 Designs for a new Audit Shark logo?
You did. You mentioned that to me.
I finally went through and actually approved one and got all the files and everything transferred. So I've got that. I already sent that off to the designer who's working on the sales website template that I'm going to be using. And hopefully he'll be integrating that in shortly. And I'm hoping to get some screenshots and stuff back just to kind of see what he's working on in the next couple of days. But the logo, I think, turned out really, really well. I ended up with, I think, 110 different designs to choose from. There were probably three that I thought were in my top three. It was basically those three that I kind of worked through a couple of different iterations. And there was a fourth one that I kind of threw in at the end just to make it into the finals. If you're not familiar with how 99 Designs works when you're doing a logo contest, basically you pay a specified amount, whether it's a bronze, silver, or gold contest, and you pay more for the gold contest than you do for the bronze. And the one I did was, I think, $500. And people will just start submitting their designs to you, and you get to rate them and comment on them and send them back for revisions or whatever. And they'll just keep submitting them to you as long as you are, I'd say, pretty diligent about providing feedback about what you like, what you don't like. When it gets to a certain point, I think it's about 3.5 days in, they kind of draw the line, and you have to pick your designers who you want to move on to the finals. There's certain designs that people will come up with, and you just don't like anything that they come up with. So those are the people you wouldn't want to bring on to the finalist stage. And then of those, I just picked four to go on to the finalists. And then of those four, I picked one of their designs and had them tweak a couple of things. And what was it? I think 5 or 6 days, and it was done.
How cool. How much did that wind up costing?
It was $4.99. So
cool.
$500. One of the things that was kind of interesting was I put it out on Twitter that I had been running this contest, and somebody called me out on it over episode 71 via Twitter. And if you'll recall, episode 71, it was things you shouldn't pay for early on in your business.
You know, it's funny. I was just going to mention this because that's one thing I don't pay for. I don't have logos for anything. Like, I do it on purpose now. Like, the Academy has no logo. The only reason Hittail had a logo is because the designer who was redesigning it said, I need to put a logo here. And I said, just put text. And he said, no, I have to do it. So he just did a one-off logo. But yeah, so I was going to ask you about that and give you a little crap about it, but I'm glad someone else headed me off.
No, I mean, he did. And, you know, it's a good point. I think that a lot of things that I said there still hold true. I mean, which was primarily, if it's not making you money and it's not going to make you money, then what difference does it really make? But at the other end of the spectrum is, you know, I would still have to have something there. And I would have to have some, at the very least, stylized text. And you can look at stylized text and say, well, that's the logo. And I was like, well, I don't really want that. And it was more of a personal preference on this particular product. In looking what I ended up choosing, I think that it fits really, really well.
And here's the thing. You can make general rules. Like we talked about on 71, you shouldn't spend money on stuff, you know, before you need to spend it. But the bottom line is there are a couple things. One, as an entrepreneur, you can have some indulgences. If you really wanted a nice logo, then go buy yourself a nice logo. You know, but when you're doing it, you know that it's not going to dramatically increase your click-through rates or your signups or anything.
Right.
You just know that going into it, that you spent that $500 and it's not necessarily going to have a high ROI. But if you needed that to like feel excited about the project, then do that. That's not a big deal as long as you know it.
Well, the other thing that does, as you said, I mean, if it excites you about the project to actually do that, and it really did. I mean, seeing the logo kind of helped energize me a little bit and put me in the right frame of mind to kind of go out and tackle a lot of other things that I kind of had on my plate for Audit Shark. So I think it was helpful for me. But at the same time, one of the things that I think is important about Audit Shark is because it is kind of a security product, I think that it lends credibility to it by having a nice logo. In many cases, a logo is probably not necessarily going to land you any sales. But at the same time, I think for this particular product, having a logo is going to help it land sales that might have otherwise been on the fence.
Right. You can definitely take it too far. And, you know, I talked about indulgences and doing stuff just to get you excited. And you can spend hundreds of hours or thousands of dollars doing something stupid just because it gets you excited. Obviously, you don't want to go that far, but you're not doing that here. And I would agree with you. Like, we've talked about different ways, kind of the tiers of building sales websites. And at the very bottom, buy an HTML template. Right above that, you can buy a premium WordPress theme. Above that, you can get a kind of a low-end custom design. Then you can go higher end. And I've definitely done all of those tiers. And I know that they impact click-through rates and they impact conversion rates. But for some of them, like when I redid Hittail, I paid top dollar. I paid the most I've ever paid for a design ever, you know, in all of the sites that I built. And that was a little bit of an indulgence, but it was also a little bit of me getting really excited about the idea and wanting something that I could be proud of. And third, it was, like you said, it was about building some credibility for this thing because it is kind of bringing something to another level, right? It's not some really tiny niche product. It's something that you do want to have a lot of credibility. And therefore, there's some give and take there. There's some things that may be on the border of, you know, how early you should have them done and how much you should pay for them. And if you have the money and you really are going to kind of go bigger and go with a bigger idea, then some of those things can be done earlier on, or you can invest more money than you otherwise would if you were maybe going after, you know, more of a niche idea or you were more cash strapped.
Because I know that there's money here, I think it makes it a little different. So if this was a new idea that I didn't know if it was going to fly, that's when I would probably be a lot less likely to spend the money on, you know, a logo. In just running this survey, I've got anywhere from $1,500 to $2,500 worth of commitment so far based on, you know, the survey. I can definitely see that there's money there. So it doesn't bother me to spend $500 on making it look nice.
Right. Now, you said something there. You said, because I know this is going to work. And I personally think that's taking it too far at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like you've gotten some positive affirmation of your hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, at least, and maybe I'm a pessimist or something, but in the back of my mind, it's like, no, you still need to prove this out.
I guess no is probably not necessarily 100%. I'm fairly confident that I'm on the right track. Not necessarily that this is going to work and I know exactly what I'm doing. It's more that I'm on the right path. That's more right. What it is, I think.
You're encouraged, yeah.
No, yeah.
That I would agree with.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into a little indulgence of my own last week. I was knee deep in code doing that one click article feature. And just for kicks, I wanted to try out a little bit of paid customer acquisition. So I set up some Facebook ads and had kind of a blast with it. I'd forgotten how much work it is to set up and maintain Facebook ads because they just burn through people so quickly.
Wow.
For those who haven't...
Kind of like their stock price as it goes down, right?
Oh my gosh. Tell me that's not a disaster. Anyways, that's a whole other podcast. But yep. But it was fun. With Facebook ads, you target a demographic and you try to get the demographic to a certain size. And then you really got to go for the visual. The visual and the headline are, for the most part, all that counts to get the attention. But then you basically, Facebook just shows the ads over and over to the same group. If you niche it down properly, then your number of people that you're displaying it to is not huge. And so Facebook will repeatedly show it to those people. And so if your click-through rate goes high, your cost per click goes low, but then pretty soon your click-through rate just plummets because people get blind to the ad because they've seen it so much. So realistically, like if you put an ad up and you have a, you know, an audience size based on the demographics you've chosen of around 100,000 people, it's like 2 or 3 days and the ad is done. And so I put up 3 or 4 ads, A/B testing a bunch of different stuff, and they were just gone in like 2.5 days. And then I put up like 9 the next time. And I had a bunch of, you know, images I was using, different headline combinations and testing. And it was fun. I was spending about 20 to 30 minutes a day on it. And in total, I actually got pretty good click-through rates, about 50 cents a click. And I spent about $300. Yeah, it was a fun experiment. I wound up getting a bunch of trials anyways. And at my current trial to paid conversion rate, it looks like I will be about 6 months of the average revenue to acquire a customer.
Huh.
So if that makes sense. So it's about 6 months of my average revenue number in order to acquire each of those customers, assuming they convert the way my other customers do from trial to paid. So now I want to get that down to below that. I want it to be more around 3. Since I'm bootstrapping, I don't have this huge pool of cash to dump on it. But it was a fun experiment. I shut it off. It was way too much work. The thing was for the amount of work and even, you know, kind of the money I was investing, there I have so many other options at this point that will work better than that.
I can see that. So when you're, I guess, doing these Facebook ads, I mean, do you have a lot of control over how much, I guess, gets spent or how much they get showed to people? I guess, how much control over the process do you have?
So first, you specify all types of demographic information, right? Mm-hmm. What they're interested in and what they have in their profile and their age range, their gender, you know, all this different stuff. And then you can do cost per click, and then Facebook will just show it as much as they think. They have an algorithm, obviously, that shows it. And if your click-through rate is high right off the bat, then they'll drop your cost per click and they'll show it a lot more because they want to make it makes them money and it makes you money.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also choose cost per thousand, right, CPM,
mm-hmm.
where it's not cost per click, but it's actually cost per thousand impressions. And that way was a little different. They still had an algorithm, but they seemed to show it a lot more. They kind of didn't care about the click-through rate, right? Because that's not what they're billing on. And so that was allowed me to get the ad in front of more people. And so I tooled around with both of them. On this one, I got the better click-through rate using the cost per click. In other campaigns I've done, I've had CPM work better. So it varies from time to time. I'm sure there's a rule, certain people can get a phenomenal click-through rates with CPM, I've heard, and I've seen that happen on 1 or 2 campaigns. And then from there, you set your daily budget. That's how much is shown, right, is once it's out of money, then it stops showing.
Got it. Yeah, I was just kind of curious how Facebook's model for advertising stacked up against like Google AdWords. So
Yeah, it's definitely getting more sophisticated. It was pretty simple about a year, year and a half ago, but they're adding more features, and I think the algorithm is getting a little better. I mean, I imagine now that they've IPO'd, you know, they really need to kind of take this up a notch.
Yeah, and I would imagine that they probably have a lot more data about the users that they're showing these to figure out whether or not it's going to fly for them or not. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've been doing some data analysis on my end for the WooFoo surveys that I did for Audit Shark. And one of the things that I found that it's interesting but not surprising is that the people who have Windows servers are willing to pay roughly twice what the Linux admins are for the same thing.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense, right?
it makes sense, but it also makes pricing difficult, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I had roughly the same amount of people who had Windows servers as had Linux or Unix servers. So
I was going to ask you that. Yeah. That's something, you know, I was talking, I mean, this was a couple years ago, but Joel Spolsky had said, we were at the Business of Software speaker dinner. He and I were sitting two chairs down from each other, and there was this whole discussion about Linux versus Windows users and all that stuff.
Yep.
He basically said that their Linux users of Fogbugs were only, it was a very small percentage, it was somewhere around 15% or 20%, but that they, at least for them, for their market, it actually accounted for a substantially higher percentage of their support issues. It must be because, some people had said, well, it's because they're more hobbyists, you know, they're into PHP or whatever, so they're not going to be into the Microsoft stack, looking for a cheaper solution, and they don't, maybe not as enterprisey or don't know what they're doing as much. Other people had said, well, maybe your Linux product isn't as good, or it crashes more or something, and he, you know, contended that it didn't. So that's an interesting thing to think about too. I wonder if there will be any kind of ease of use or higher support burdens if you go Linux versus Windows or go both.
Yeah, that's one of those things that it worries me a little bit, just because if I kind of go down on the price in order to gain those Linux customers, is it going to kill me on the support side of things?
Yeah, seriously. And so you're not going to charge $99 for Linux and $199 for Microsoft Windows? Would you? I would have to lean towards going Windows only when you launch then.
I mean,
you got to go for the higher end to start with, right?
Right, right.
Especially if you have equal amounts. I was going to say, if you have more or the same amount of Windows.
Yeah, I think I'd have to go back and double check the spreadsheet. But I think that there were, it was roughly equivalent in terms of the respondents. I know that there was one person who had come in and said, yeah, I'd pay for it. But it really skewed the numbers because they had like, you know, 75 Linux servers or something like that. So that made up the bulk of them. But in terms of actual number of people who chose them, it was significantly less. But yeah, I mean, the distribution, I'm looking at it now. There was 8 who had said Windows on this spreadsheet. So on this particular one, there's 8 of them in here that say Windows, and then 16 who said Linux.
That's not 50-50.
It's not, but the people who had Windows servers tended to have more. It's with a couple of exceptions. There was the one that, like I said, had 75 that skewed it pretty far in the direction of Linux. But otherwise, it was mostly that. And the other thing is people could answer more than one thing. So there were several people who had both Windows and Linux.
What are you going to do? You think you'll go come out Windows only and do the higher price to start with?
I'm still trying to figure it out. Because one of the things I'm looking at is a lot of the competitive products that are out there. I mean, because I asked, what do you currently use for monitoring on your server? Because Ted from Moreware had, I kind of ran my survey past him first and just to get some feedback on it. And he's like, this looks good. The one thing I'd ask is what other monitoring solutions people pay for already, because that might be kind of a self-selecting crowd of people who are willing to pay for those types of things, which gave me a great idea. It was like, oh, well, if you're already paying for those things, then, you know, it would make sense for me to either integrate with them or partner with them in ways that would allow me to, you know, use my software alongside of theirs, etc. People pointed out what other tools that they use to monitor their servers. So I got a lot of information that I probably wouldn't have gained otherwise. And, you know, just been looking at some of those offerings, what they do. And some of them I've just never heard of before. And then other ones like, you know, Pingdom and CloudWatch. I mean, those things, you know, pretty straightforward, and I'll call them more well-known. You know, it's just interesting looking at all that data.
Yeah, it is. And you know where that helps you is this concept that I've been touting in one of my talks called integration marketing. And there's a few entrepreneurs doing it really well right now. And I'm actually diving into that. My next marketing/technology challenge with Hittail is I have 4 different companies that want to integrate with me. So that I will either create an API and have them ping in and grab some keyword suggestions, or, you know, I'll go out and integrate with their app marketplace. And the cool part of it is I'm only integrating with people who already have customer bases and are willing to either email or blog about the integration. And so I get this link and a mention, and it sends a bunch of traffic. You know, it's not, it doesn't have a long flywheel effect, but you know, what it brings is this nice big chunk of people who kind of signs up for the product. And since it's a SaaS app, you get the recurring revenue from them. It's not, I mean, really the cost is to do the integration, you know, so either I pay someone to write the code or I write the code myself. And that's where you in your survey have just asked about future integration partners. right? Mm-hmm. If they're already using Pingdom and these other things, whether you actually do a physical code integration with them, or you just basically say, I have these customers and I'll let them know about you, and you have your customers and kind of do a joint venture email type thing. That's a great way to go. It's kind of a low cost guerrilla marketing tactic, but it works out really well. That's the next steps for me. After I get this whole article thing launched, and I'm going to do a little promotion over the Chinese character thing as well, and then move on to these things, which have been on the book since like February. I started getting contacted in November, December from a few shopping cart vendors and a couple other companies that will remain nameless right now. But I'm pretty excited about doing that. These companies have, a few of them have tens of thousands of active paying customers. So mm-hmm. could be a nice expansion of the customer base.
Yeah, definitely building an API that people can kind of interface with and get data in or out of your product is helpful in leveraging your product as more of a platform. You know, as more people do it, it just gives you a larger breadth, increasing your luck surface area, I believe.
Right, from texting. But, you know, in terms of the API, I would never go out and just build an API and say, all right, here's my API. People can use it, because that requires marketing too, right? You have to go out and recruit people to do it.
Right.
The only reason I'm building one is because I have 4 people on board ready to do it now, and I vetted them. They have, you know, between 500 and tens of thousands of paying customers, and they are ideal integration partners because they are like shopping cart vendors are a great candidate for Hittail because e-commerce sites get a lot of value out of it. And then there's a few others that are marketing type software that where just the keyword suggestions really, you know, would work well. And a couple of them, again, I'm integrating into their ecosystem, and a couple of them are going to pull from me and need an API from my end. So, but yeah, I would never just go out and build. You do see these kind of, it was like the Web 2.0 thing, right? It was to become a platform and build an API. And I don't think that's a good move straight up front. I mean, I think you have someone need it before you build it.
And those people who need it, you simply work with them to figure out what it is that they need, and you build exactly. that stuff into an API. And then as other people start using it and leveraging it, then you build out other things on top of it. You don't just...
Exactly. No, that's right. And my API right now, it's all built. It's one call, one method call, get suggestions. That's all it is. You know, there's authentication and then there's get suggestions, because that's all I need right now. You mm-hmm. know, and someday someone will need some dynamic tracking code, and then we'll build that out. So it's an MVF as well. Minimum viable feature. I think I need to write a blog post about MVF, because I Googled for it. I'm like, someone surely has talked about this before. And of course, it's nowhere to be found. So maybe we'll rank for it with the transcript of this podcast.
Yeah, maybe. It's funny that you mention building an API, because with Audit Shark, the way a lot of the data is passed back and forth, it's all done through web services. So in a way, I almost have an API that's kind of sitting there. It's just not documented for anybody else to use.
And you need authentication layer on there, security authorization authentication.
You yep. do, but I use a token for just about everything.
Oh, nice.
And that token's built into the product. I think it'd be pretty easy to surface that in other locations, but I think mine is probably different than most API tokens, in that my token is only valid for about an hour. So right. most services you sign up for them, they have this API token, and it, you know, you can click a button and reset it at any time, but otherwise it's valid until the end of time. My system, when you pass things back and forth, it establishes a token which is randomly generated for you, and that token is valid for the next 60 minutes. And if it times out while you're in the middle of doing something, then the next function call will basically say, hey, this token just timed out. You're going to have to request a new one.
Nice.
So
yeah, so it sounds like you got some of that built in already.
Yeah.
Have I talked about Operation Retention?
No. What is it?
This was like the big movement in January when I relaunched Hittail. I got this big influx of traffic, and then 30 days later, when the trials ended, I got to start seeing the conversion rate from mm-hmm. trial to paid, and then I started watching the churn rate of paid customers, how many cancel per month. And right away, it was not good. I was just like clutching my eyes as I watched these numbers go in the wrong direction, and they were bad. They weren't anywhere near the goals that I had. So I started doing a bunch of marketing, and a bunch of people were coming in, but I had this leaky funnel, right? And it was better than the old Hittail design. It was better than the old Hittail trial, all that stuff, but it wasn't where I wanted it to be. So I sat down and I wrote in my notebook, I said, Operation Retention. All I'm going to focus on, I'm going to stop all marketing, I'm going to stop anything that takes my time, and I'm going to focus on getting the churn rate down, driving the trial to paid conversion rate up. Because the number of visits to trials was great. Like it's totally in the range of where it should be. I could tweak and get a little more out of it, you know, test copy and A/B and stuff. But the big glaring bottlenecks, the big holes, were the trial to paid conversions and the cancellation rate early on. So I wrote down 8 things. I contacted customers. I had my VA contact everybody who canceled, ask them why they canceled. I put together a spreadsheet, and I figured out that there were 7 or 8 main reasons people were objecting. And some of them included things like, it adds things to my to-do list. I want to be able to one-click an article, and that's why I built this feature. Others said, they said things that alluded to the fact that they didn't understand how the product worked. So they would say like, well, the suggestions are all around the same topic, and that doesn't help me. Whereas that's actually a really good thing. And so I realized I needed to educate. And so there were 3 or 4 that were like that, where I needed more education. I needed people who are using it to understand how it works, understand the benefit they could get out of it. So I listed these things out, and one by one, I've been scratching them off. And with the release of the one-click article feature, it's done. The education I did through screencasts during the trial, and so people get a few emails during the trial, and I basically just had a question in there, and then it would have a one-sentence answer, and then link off to a screencast. Now, since I started Operation Retention, my trial-to-paid conversion rate is up 100%. It has doubled.
Wow.
Yeah, in 3 months. And I'm super stoked about that, as you can imagine. And then the other thing, the churn rate is 1/2 of what it was when I started. So I've 4x'd the funnel, in essence.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah. So I'm going to go into more detail about it. I'm probably going to write maybe a book chapter on it. There's just, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I tried that worked. Some of it didn't work. There's still tweaks to be made. And it is kind of a minimum viable effort, an MVE at this point. Now I'm just getting ridiculous with that. But no, it's like some of the screencasts, I mean, they're not like fantastic. They're not well produced. It was me sitting there recording for 45 seconds and then just pushing it onto the server because I wanted to get this stuff done as quickly as possible. But even with that kind of homebrewed effort of really not having stuff professionally done and not spending a ton of time thinking it through, it had a dramatic impact on these numbers. So I'm super stoked. I'm stoked that it worked. I'm stoked that kind of the hypothesis was validated, and just that, you know, all the stuff that we talk about, it holds true, man.
Very cool.
Building the funnel, plugging the holes.
So if you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email us at questions@startupsarestos.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups, or via RSS at startupsarestos.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.